there was a chance that we would prevail. But it is now clear that even when all the provisional ballots are counted, which they will be, there won't be enough outstanding votes for us to be able to win Ohio. And therefore, we cannot win this election. My friends, it was here that we began our campaign for the presidency. And all we had was hope and a vision for a better America. It was a privilege and a gift to spend 2 years traveling this country, coming to know so many of you. I wish that I could just wrap you up in my arms and embrace each and every one of you individually all across this nation. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We still got your back.
Thank you, man. And I assure you, you watch, I'll still love yours. So thank you, man. I will always be particularly grateful to the colleague that you just heard from, who became my partner, my very close friend, an extraordinary leader, John Edwards. And I thank him for everything he did. And thank you, sir. John and I would be the first to tell you that we owe so much to our families. They're here with us today. They were with us every single step of the way. They sustained us. They went out on their own and they multiplied our campaign all across this country. No one did this more with grace and with courage and candor that I love than my wife, Teresa. And I thank her. And our children were there every single step of the way. It was unbelievable. Vanessa, Alex, Chris, Andre, and John from my family, and Elizabeth Edwards, who is so remarkable and so strong and so smart. And Johnny and Kate, who went out there on her own, just like my daughters did, and also Emma, Claire, and Jack, who were up beyond their bedtime last night, like a lot of us. I want to thank my crewmates and my friends from 35 years ago, that great band of brothers who crisscrossed this country on my behalf for 2004. They had the courage to speak the truth back then, and they spoke it again this year, and for that I will forever be grateful. And thanks also, as I look around here, to friends and family of a lifetime, some from college, friends made all across the years, and then all across the miles of this campaign. You are so special. You brought the gift of your passion for our country and the possibilities of change, and that will stay with us and with this country forever. Thanks to Democrats and Republicans and independents who stood with us and everyone who voted, no matter who their candidate was. And thanks to my absolutely unbelievable, dedicated staff led by a wonderful campaign manager, Mary Beth Cahill, who did an extraordinary job. There's so much written about campaigns, and there's so much that Americans never get to see. I wish they could all spend a day on a campaign and see how hard these folks work to make America better. It is its own unbelievable contribution to our democracy, and it's a gift to everybody, but especially to me. And I'm grateful to each and every one of you. And I thank your families, and I thank you for the sacrifices you've made. And to all the volunteers all across this country who gave so much of themselves. You know, thanks to William Field, a six-year-old who collected $680, a quarter and a dollar at a time, selling bracelets during the summer to help change America. Thanks to... Thanks to Michael Benson from Florida, who I spied in a rope line holding a container of money, and it turned out he'd raided his piggy bank and wanted to contribute. And thanks to Alana Wexler, 11 years old, who started Kids for Kerry all across our country. I think of the brigades of students and people, young and old, who took time to travel, time off from work, their own vacation time to work in states far and wide. They braved the hot days of summer and the cold days of the fall and the winter to knock on doors because they were determined to open the doors of opportunity to all Americans. They worked their hearts out, and I wish you know how much that I could have brought this race home for you, for them. And I say to them now, don't lose faith. What you did made a difference, and building on itself. Building on itself, we go on to make a difference another day. I promise you, that time will come. The time will come, the election will come, when your work and your ballots will change the world, and it's worth fighting for. I want to especially say to the American people, in this journey, you have given me the honor and the gift of listening and learning from you. I have visited your homes, I've visited your churches, I've visited your community halls, I've heard your stories, I know your struggles, I know your hopes. They are part of me now. And I will never forget you, and I'll never stop fighting for you. You may not understand completely in what ways, but it is true when I say to you that you have taught me and you've tested me and you've lifted me up and you've made me stronger. I did my best to express my vision and my hopes for America. We worked hard and we fought hard, and I wish that things had turned out a little differently. But in an American election, there are no losers. Because whether or not our candidates are successful, the next morning we all wake up as Americans. And that that is the greatest privilege and the most remarkable good fortune that can come to us on Earth. With that gift also comes obligation. We are required now to work together for the good of our country. In the days ahead, we must find common cause. We must join in common effort, without remorse or recrimination, without anger or rancor. America is in need of unity and longing for a larger measure of compassion. I hope President Bush will advance those values in the coming years. I pledge to do my part to try to bridge the partisan divide. I know this is a difficult time for my supporters, but I ask them, all of you, to join me in doing that. Now more than ever, with our soldiers in harm's way, we must stand together and succeed in Iraq and win the war on terror. I will also do everything in my power to ensure that my party, a proud Democratic Party, stands true to our best hopes and ideals. I believe that what we started in this campaign will not end here. And I know our fight goes on to put America back to work and to make our economy a great engine of job growth. Our fight goes on to make affordable health care an accessible right for all Americans, not a privilege. Our fight goes on to protect the environment, to achieve equality, to push the frontiers of science and discovery, and to restore America's reputation in the world. I believe that all of this will happen, and sooner than we may think, because we're America, and America always moves forward. I've been honored to represent the citizens of this Commonwealth for the United States Senate now for 20 years. And I pledge to them that in the years ahead, I'm going to fight on for the people and for the principles that I've learned and lived with here in Massachusetts. I'm proud of what we stood for in this campaign and of what we accomplished. When we began, no one thought it was possible to even make this a close race. But we stood for real change, change that would make a real difference in the life of our nation, in the lives of our families. And we defined that choice to America. I'll never forget the wonderful people who came to our rallies, who stood in our rope lines, who put their hopes in our hands, who invested in each and every one of us. I saw in them the truth that America is not only great, but it is good. So here, with a grateful heart, I leave this campaign with a prayer that has even greater meaning to me now that I've come to know our vast country so much better. It's thanks to all of you, and what a privilege it has been to do so. And that prayer is very simple. God bless America. Thank you.
The crowd in Boston's Faneuil Hall rising to its feet to give one last cheer for the presidential campaign of John F. Kerry, junior senator from Massachusetts, who has offered his congratulations to President Bush. As you heard, he was somewhat hoarse and somewhat subdued. His running mate, John Edwards, has joined him now on the stage at Faneuil Hall. They're embracing members of their families as this campaign comes to an end. You're listening to live coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington as our live special coverage on NPR News continues. You heard Senator Kerry there finishing up the last business of his campaign, the sad and melancholy affair of telling his supporters that there was no way that even once all the provisional votes were counted in the state of Ohio, there was no way to overcome the lead that President Bush had established in the race. He said all of those votes would be counted, but even so, the arithmetic did not add up in his favor. There was no way to win Ohio, he said, and therefore the race was lost. I would not have given up the fight, he said, if there was a hope we could prevail. He then called for unity with the re-elected administration. In the days ahead, he said, we must find common cause without remorse or rancor. Well, joining us now is NPR's Don Gagne. He's at the Bush-Cheney Victory Party at the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown Washington, D.C., where the president is expected to be addressing his supporters in about 40 minutes from now. Don, good to speak with you again.
Hi, Neil.
Was the speech by Senator Kerry available there in the Ronald Reagan Building?
It was indeed. People are gathering here. A lot of them were here last night, went home, took a nap, and are back now, showered and with fresh clothing on. But there are giant video screens, projection video screens, and they watched the speech, and it's interesting. It's almost like there was no reaction. People were quiet. They watched it. They did cheer when Senator Kerry officially announced that he had called the president and that he had conceded the race. But they just stood and watched it played out. Then the minute he finished, this music that you hear in the background now cranked up, and people are waving American flags and getting ready to see the speech that they had all hoped to see from the president last night, that formal acceptance speech from a president looking ahead to a second term.
Well, as you mentioned, there has to be a degree of exhaustion in the crowd there, but obviously
Absolutely.
Celebrating as well.
Exactly. I mean, people are really thrilled that he is doing this here and not just making an announcement at the White House, at the Rose Garden. A lot of them have put in a lot of hours on this campaign. A lot of them put in a lot of hours here yesterday alone. So there's a good deal of excitement. And even though it's much later than they had hoped, it's a day later than they had hoped, it looks like a big Bush-Cheney campaign rally.
Mm-hmm. One more question, Don. And that had to, you said there was a cheer when Senator Kerry officially conceded, but no reaction to his call for unity in the days ahead.
No, it was people watched it. You know, the thing is, last night when we were here, every time John Edwards or John Kerry's image appeared up on the giant TV screens, you heard boos and things like that. There was none of that. People listened respectfully. They paid attention. But the only time they really expressed anything as a crowd, as a group, was when he announced the official concession.
Well, Don Gagne, thanks. And we'll be back with you, I guess, in about 35 minutes or so, when President Bush is expected to make his speech and arrive there at the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown Washington. And thanks very much, Don.
All right, we'll stand by.
NPR's Don Gagne from the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown Washington. Exit polls yesterday showed there was one key motivator for Republican voters beyond terrorism, the economy, or the war in Iraq. It was called moral values, but the question didn't define what moral values are. Here's Andrew Kohut of the Pew Research Center.
That's the problem. I suspect that if moral values were defined in terms of specifics, we might have had a different kind of response. And to a certain extent, I think moral values also might be code.
Code for what? Abortion? Gay marriage? Christianity? How do you think moral values affected this election? How do you define them? Give us a call. We have two phone numbers today. If you voted for President Bush or might have, the number is 800-344-3893. Again, 800-344-3893. If you voted for Senator Kerry or would have, the number is 800-344-3864. Again, 800-344-3864. Joining us now to talk about the role of values in this election is Jean Bethke Elstein, professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago, on the road this afternoon. We thank her for taking the time to join us. Good to speak with you again.
Thank Thank you, Neil.
Were you surprised at the number of people who gave that moral values answer as the most important reason that they voted yesterday?
Not at all. I've been saying for a number of years that we really mistake and misunderstand American voters if we think that pocketbook issues are going to prevail, which is, of course, common wisdom among many political scientists, but that instead Americans are animated by complex cluster of questions, including this admittedly amorphous moral values. But I suspect that if you started to break it down into a series of particular concerns, it would have to do with a number of very volatile issues, our continuing travail over abortion, the whole question of embryonic stem cells and their use, which means their destruction to harvest stem cells for research. It would include clearly the issue about marriage, gay marriage, is marriage just between men and women, but not just those. It would also include, I think, a deeper sense of a kind of moral uneasiness about the direction the country is going. Too much pornography, too much explicit sex, too much, even too much commercialization and marketing to young children as an explicit moral concern. So I think it's a whole range of issues.
Why, some people might ask, why are those defined as moral values while issues like social justice, issues like peace, those are not?
Well, I think that those are defined as moral values, but I suspect that issues of social justice, people tend to reason like this, that the way those issues are addressed is going to emerge from debates over and the fine-tuning of certain public policy interventions. So there's the moral dimension doesn't come out quite as clearly, I think, or as pointedly or as poignantly. But I think on these other moral issues that there's a deep fear that many of these questions, if you will, are going to be simply taken away from people by the resort to the courts, by judicial fiat. That, of course, has been one of the continuing vexations on the abortion question. Shouldn't people have had an opportunity to vote, you know, in their respective legislatures about this? So that, I suspect, is perhaps the difference. People know that there are going to be votes that have to do with tax policy and economic policy and all the rest. But about these other issues, I think there's a worry we won't get to have a say on them.
And, of course, the next president of the United States, which will, of course, now be George Bush, the next president will be able to appoint perhaps as many as four justices to the Supreme Court of the United States, and perhaps that illness by Chief Justice Rehnquist played more of a part in this election than we may have thought.
You know, it may well have. I think America, we underestimate American voters rather consistently. I think they pay a lot of attention to what's going on once the election draws nearer and nearer. And I think the worry, again, that the Supreme Court might simply take a whole range of issues out of their hands rather than say, you know what, this isn't a matter for us, it should go back to the states and so on, that undoubtedly played a role with many people. But I suspect, Neil, that it was this more generalized sense of uneasiness that the moral fiber of the nation is unraveled a bit. And for a number of reasons, I think President Bush was seen as someone who understood that, and Senator Kerry was seen as someone who did not.
And we invite you to join this conversation as we await the president's victory speech, which is coming at the top of this hour. At least that's when it's scheduled.
All right.
A Bush supporter is 800-344-3893. Again, 800-344-3893. Kerry supporters can call 800-344-3864. How do you define moral values? What part do you think they played in this election? And we'll begin with Bruce on the Republican line from Waltham, Massachusetts.
Good afternoon. Although I dial the Republican line, I guess I should open by saying I voted both Democratic and Republican over various presidential elections, although I did vote for Bush this particular time. I am the one of five people in all of Massachusetts that apparently voted for Bush. But I don't really think this was about moral values at all, and I know this is a popular topic today in the pundits and the polls and so on, but I think really that it's sort of masking a lot of other issues. I mean, in my case, I'm for stem cell research. I'm favorable toward gay marriage. I have gay friends who are actually married. I'm pro-choice. to me, it's more about what you feel the role of the government is. And I think in people I've talked to, one of the central things that you expect your government to do is to protect you. And I don't really expect them to be in my bedroom or my neighbor's bedroom or talk about, you know, things that are happening with women's bodies or whatever. But I do expect them to protect me from external forces, which would include terrorists or other countries or so on. And, you know, obviously that's a very hot issue and can be debated a lot of ways, and I won't go into all that. But since the topic was on moral issues, that really wasn't an issue for me at all. I mean, my personal feeling is that even if Bush comes out against for a constitutional amendment against gay marriage, it simply isn't tenable to make it pass. I mean, you would require all the states to pass it essentially to change the Constitution, and I just don't feel that that's something that's likely to happen. So I was able to let that issue go. In fact, I would say I was totally against Bush's moral stand on some of these things, but I voted for him because I didn't feel he could actually affect that change, because I think it's coming anyway.
Okay, and we should point out, I think moral values was number one in people's response, but I think the war on terrorism was number two, and then
exactly.
On down the line.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think Bruce is very articulate in offering his reasons for why he voted for President Bush, really despite the president's views on some of these other issues. But I think we have to give some credence, clearly, to people's self-characterizations of what were the most important issues for them. And clearly they had an opportunity to distinguish between moral values questions, economic questions, and the war peace questions, the war on terrorism. And all of these were important, but what is surprising everyone this morning is just 10 this afternoon how important the moral values separated from the security protection and terrorism issues proved to be. And here, let me respond for a moment to President candidate Kerry's concession speech. It struck me that he, during the campaign, lost some real opportunities to precisely do the unifying that he called for in his very graceful speech. That is to say, for example, at the Democratic National Convention, when apropos the whole debate about the morality of creating and destroying embryos for research, he simply left the moral debate aside and said, we need a president who believes in science. And then went on from there, and sort of, you know, my faith tells me one thing, but science tells me another. And I think those are the kinds of issues that trouble people, that they want some acknowledgement of their moral uneasiness. I don't think that Kerry would have to say, I absolutely agree with those of you who think we should never use embryonic stem cells. But I think what people want is some recognition that there is a moral question, just as there's a moral question in the abortion debate over the moral status of the fetus or of the unborn child. So I think just acknowledging that would have helped him tremendously and helped to allay the worries of many people that he was simply, he was simply deaf to these concerns.
If I could just make one more point before I leave here.
Sure.
Okay, Bruce.
Obviously, it's valid to consider the self-described characteristics of people in the exit polls.
Yeah.
The only comment I would say is if the exit polls were accurate, John Kerry would be president today. So I think another thing you're looking at in the day-after analysis is really how accurate are the exit polls? Obviously, they have a great deal of predictive validity, but I'm not sure this is a level of accuracy when you have roughly 59 million people voting for Bush. I think it's hard to characterize them as, you know, mostly falling in for one issue or another issue. You walk out of the polls, you're busy, you're trying to go somewhere, someone hits you with a question, you kind of throw the first thing off the top of your head and you keep walking.
Bruce, I'm told by the professionals that the exit polls were accurate. They were just accurate for the early voters.
Yes.
Other people voted later.
Yes.
Well, but that's not how they're characterized when they're represented, are they?
No, they're generally characterized as early exit polls, preliminary results. But, well, Bruce, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
All right. We do have an election update. There was one outstanding Senate race that was yet to be decided. NPR has now projected that Lisa Murkowski, the incumbent senator appointed to the office by her father, now Governor Frank Murkowski of Alaska. Lisa Murkowski has triumphed and defeated former Alaska Governor Tony Knowles, and that race is now over. And the Republican majority in the United States Senate, they now have 55 seats in the United States Senate. That a gain of 4 from the previous United States Senate. Anyway, we're going to continue our conversation with Jean Bethke Elstein, and let's get another caller on the line. This is Stephen. Stephen's calling from Ames, Iowa, on the Democratic line.
Good afternoon. Actually, I suppose I should preface this. I'm actually not Democratic. I'm an independent voter. However, I did vote for Kerry this election.
Okay.
And what I'm worried about, and you know, you were mentioning of moral values, is that what I've seen is a growing divide within the United States between the Christian right and what I would consider a more moderate citizens. And I'm actually quite I'm quite frightened by the possibility of what's going to happen inside of the United States with what I would consider, rather than a Republican, I would say that we have more of a neocon dominance inside the Senate and the House currently. And what concerns me the most now is that, you know, since Kerry lost, is that I foresee a lot of the our civil rights, basic civil rights, becoming severely eroded, and more so than they have been over the last 4 years. So I think that the question that was asked about moral values was quite relevant, and I think that it's kind of a specter that's going to haunt us for quite a while.
Stephen, it seems to me that, and again, I understand your worries, but I think we make a mistake if we think that the issues of moral values somehow are limited to those that are part of what's called the Christian right. That is, I think this moral uneasiness that I talked about is very widely shared. For example, the leading journal of liberal opinion, named the Christian Century, which is a journal that opposes the war in Iraq and very strong on social justice issues, against capital punishment and so on, nevertheless expressed in an editorial very strong opposition to the use of embryonic stem cells, calling it an unprecedented instrumentalization of human life. So I think that these kinds of issues affect many millions of people outside any purview of a narrow segment of the population. Now, that doesn't speak to some of your direct political concerns, but I do think that we shouldn't, that there's a way of evading the moral concerns when we limit them to one group and say it's that one group and they're in danger of taking over. These are more widespread kinds of concerns, and I think we're really obliged to think about what's going on as we reflect on them, rather than to sort of deflect the issues by locating them in one group that we strongly oppose, and then we don't think reflectively about the issues, the moral issues, the moral values questions themselves.
Let me, if Stephen doesn't mind, frame that just another way. The president, throughout his campaign, talked about his resolution and his firmness, his adherence, his certainty, and that this was based to some degree in his faith.
Yes.
Obviously, many voters found that reassuring. I think other voters, Kerry supporters, I think it was Senator Kerry pointed out in one of the debates, you can be certain and be wrong.
Yes. No, I think that's right, and I believe that it's the obligation of any president, as he's discussing his resoluteness and his firmness and his convictions, to acknowledge always that which is certainly part of the tradition that the president shares, that it's quite possible for weak and frail human beings to be wrong, and that one always has to be prepared to acknowledge where one has made mistakes and to acknowledge where one has gone wrong. And that's very much part of the Christian tradition. So I do think that that's terribly important. We have many models of presidents who have precisely done that. Abraham Lincoln perhaps being the most significant, when he said, I confess that I have not controlled events. They have controlled me. And who looked for a certain, embodied a certain humility when he looked at the carnage of the Civil War. So I do believe that it's important for leaders to be resolute. That's absolutely true. But it's also important for them to acknowledge that presidents, like anybody else, can err.
And that's one of my concerns, is that when we have a president who steadfastly refuses to even pretty much acknowledge the possibility of error, especially on such issues as, well, when we're talking about social justice, we're talking about a war that the rest of the world, or a fair chunk of the rest of the world, has found our reasonings for going to war to be very flimsy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a president who is now, in the face of what would be considered, you know, logical, rather than logical analysis, he fails to acknowledge that even the possibility of making an error. I find that to be a very serious and very dangerous character fault that I would more likely ascribe to someone like Stalin or a dictator type personality, where megalomaniacal tendencies tend to keep you away from the possibility that you make any errors whatsoever.
Stephen, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're running out of time. I think a lot of people, thank you very much for the call. I'm not quite sure about the comparison to Joseph Stalin. And Jean Bethke Elstein, we wanted to thank you for stopping off on the road this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. I'm sorry it's a cell phone. Probably the quality wasn't that great. But thanks very much. Good to talk to you
again. It's the quality of the thought that counts. We appreciate
it. All right. Thank you.
Jean Bethke Elstein, Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago. We're going to continue our conversation on moral values and the role they played in the election as we await President Bush's speech at the top of the hour in about 40 minutes from now. So stay with us. This is special coverage from NPR News.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this hour, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry issued a formal concession to his supporters in Faneuil Hall in Boston, Massachusetts. At the top of the hour, 3 o'clock Eastern Time, President Bush is expected to formally declare victory to a crowd of his supporters at Bush-Cheney headquarters at the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown Washington, D.C. Stay tuned to this NPR station. We'll bring you live coverage of that when it begins. Right now, though, we are talking about an issue that emerged somewhat to the surprise of pollsters in the campaign. Throughout the long race between Kerry and Bush, the economy, the war in Iraq, terrorism were all acknowledged as issues. Yesterday, people emerging from the polls put one issue above all the others, something they called moral values. Well, what are those exactly? What does it mean? What does it mean in the context of the election? What does it mean for a divided America? If you're a Bush supporter, call us at 800-344-3893. A Kerry supporter, 800-344-3864. Joining us now is George Lakoff. He said there is a distinct divide in our culture. We just need to learn to talk constructively about each other's values. He's a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. His latest book is called Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate, The Essential Guide for Progressives. And he joins us now from his office at the Rock Ridge Institute in Berkeley, California. And it's good of you to be with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How and when did moral values come to be take such a prominent role in this election?
Well, they've been playing a prominent role in elections all the way through, from the 94 election on, and even before that. The problem is this, that the Democrats do not know how to express the unconscious values that they feel in their guts, whereas the Republicans have figured out how to do it and do it very effectively. You know, moral values are not about just abortion and same-sex marriage and stem cells. They're about much deeper issues and just about all issues. Basic idea of morality in this country comes from notions of the family. Conservative values come out of what I call a strict father family, and the progressive values come out of a nurturing parent family. And those are values that the Democrats don't know how to express. Values having to do with both care and responsibility, responsible caring, but also out of that comes protection, comes opportunity, comes the value of community, of trust,
of all of the things that progressives in this country feel very deeply and that lie behind all of their legislative proposals. But they don't know how to talk about their values. They don't know how to express them. They don't know how to come together around their values the way that the Republicans have done. So it's very important to understand that the moral values issue is not about, you know, just those few things like abortion and so on. They're about everything. What is protection about? Protection is not just about terrorism, though it is about that. It's also about environmental protection, consumer protection, worker protection, economic protection for people who are economically vulnerable. These are major, major issues that are values issues. The Democrats have made a mistake in thinking that they're self-interest issues, and that people vote their self-interest. People don't. People mostly vote their values, and that's what this shows. Mm-hmm. And the book Moral Politics that I put out some years back, you know, predicted all of this, that this is exactly what America is about. America is about values, but the press has not been up on it. The press has not figured out exactly what those values are, nor has the Democratic Party told them.
One criticism of the Democrats is that they lack the ideological fervor of the Republicans. There are a lot of different kinds of conservatives, but conservatism is at least a coherent ideology. Democrats, if they have a coherent ideology, they are unable to express that as well.
That's correct. There is a coherent ideology. It's discussed in Don't Think of an Elephant. In Chapter 8, it's gone into in great detail. But the problem is that there are also divisions among Democrats, just as there are divisions among Republicans. But the Republicans have figured out what the divisions are and what unites them. We've also figured it out here at Rockridge, but the problem is that the Democratic Party hasn't acknowledged that there are actual values that they all share, mm-hmm. and they need to be able to talk about those. And one very important thing is about religion. There are more liberal Christians in this country than there are conservative Christians. But the liberal Christians are not organized. They have liberal values, both in their religion, in their theology, and in their politics. And their theology and politics are as closely linked as the conservative theology and politics are linked. But the liberal Christians, again, can't express their theology and its relationship to their political values, and they have no organization, no spokesman, nobody out there bringing them together as the Christian coalition has brought the conservative Christians together.
Well, let's get a caller in on the conversation. Grace is with us from Opelousas, Louisiana.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Grace.
Yes, thank you. I'm a first-time voter for the first time in 30 years. In Louisiana, we had the amendment towards marriage that mm-hmm. we had in September, and I registered to vote specifically for that issue. And as you may know, 79% of the population voted for it, and an activist judge is in the courts right now. He said that it was unconstitutional, and that really goes to the grassroots of why you have seen the results in this election, is that we, as a Christian, most Christians in this nation trust that God chooses the kings, and that means the president. And we have enjoyed the luxury of religious freedom in this nation, which is what this nation was the basis of its founding. And we have seen in recent years that an oligarchy is forming in this country where activist judges are using preference over principle in their interpretation of the Constitution, assuming that this church, that the Constitution has a separation of church and state. The only Constitution in this world that had that clause in it was the Soviet Union. In the United States Constitution, they do not have a separation of church and state. So we have seen the Ten Commandments taken out of the state capitol in Alabama, and we have seen an increasing attempt to take away the Christian heritage from this country. And we are for everyone having their basic freedoms, but we have been seeing our freedoms to express our beliefs threatened increasingly more.
Freedoms are not threatened, but in fact, we do have a separation of church and state in our Constitution.
It's not.
As you read that Constitution very carefully, there's going to be no established religion in this country.
And the reason
that's very
for that
important. But in particular,
Grace is
quite wrong about the way that your freedoms have not been impugned. In fact, it's the reverse. The oligarchy in this country is the right, and the radical right, and Bush is part of the radical right. This is a radical issue. He wants to impose a hierarchy in this country, and this is not. This is supposed to be a democratic country. That hierarchy is a hierarchy of, among other things, financial success, for one thing. Secondly, a particular view, not only of Christianity, but of religion in general, a strict father version of Christianity, not a nurturant version of Christianity. And most Christians in this country follow the nurturant, not the strict father model of Christianity. Your model of Christianity is not that of most Christians in this country. And most Christians in this country want a separation of church and state, as is given in the Constitution.
And there we'll leave it for the moment. Good afternoon. You're tuned to WILL Urbana. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. President Bush is expected to speak shortly in the 2 o'clock hour here Central Time, and we will return to National Public Radio for his remarks. But we're going to pause here to find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Here now with the prices from the Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade on this post-election day, December futures in the wheat pit finished down 2 cents with a high at 304.5 and a low at 298.5. Settlement price there at $3.25. March contract in the wheat pit, 317 the high, low at 311. Settlement price at 314.25, down 0.75 in the wheat futures in the May contract, 324 the high, the low at 317.5. And their settlement price down 2 cents at 319.25. July futures 328 the high, the low at 322.5, settled there at 323.25. They were off 3 cents. And the September contract did not trade today. Settlement traded just once today, and it settled at 329.5, and it was off 3.75 at the end of this Wednesday afternoon. From the corn pit now, December futures settlement price at $1.99. Down 0.75. 201 was the high, the low at 198.75. March contract at 212.25 high, low at 210, a settlement price at 210.5, down 0.75. In the May futures, 219.75 the high, the low at 218, settlement price at 218.25, they were off a half. And July futures, 226.5 the high, the low at 224.75. Settled 225, they were off a half cent. September futures, 234.25 the high, the low at 232.5. Settled 232.5, down a half cent. In December contract, 242.25 the high, the low at 241. Settled 241.5. They finished the day unchanged for the next year's December corn contract. December oats now, 142.25 the high, the low at 139.75. Settlement price at 140 unchanged. In the March futures, 149 the high, the low at 146.75, and a settlement price at 147. They finished the day unchanged as well. From the soy complex, this is where the real action sort of took place today. Despite the fact that the numbers are not despite the fact that the numbers don't look so low, there was a lot of technical damage done in the bean pit this afternoon with a higher high than yesterday's trade and a lower low. And they finished in that November contract down 3.75. The high today, 538. The low at 521.5. Settlement price there at 524.25. That was down 3.75 cents. We'll talk to Paul Cooley during the closing market report. Just a reminder that President Bush is due to make his acceptance speech at 2 o'clock Central Daylight Time. That'd be 3 o'clock if you're in Indiana or most of Indiana. That coming up in about 6 minutes here on WILL. We will carry what portion of the closing market report that we can adjust to get into that 2 o'clock hour just after the president stops his speech, and we will bring that to you during the 2 o'clock hour Central Daylight Time as things progress through that hour and the president wraps up his acceptance speech. Now, let's go back and take a look at the January beans. They were off 7 cents today, 532 the high, the low at 516, the settlement price at 518.5. Once again, that January contract off 7. The March futures, 535 the high, the low at 520.5, a settlement price at 522.5, down 6.5 cents. And the May contract, a 539 high, low at 524, settlement price at 528.25. They were off 6.25. And July futures, a 545 high, low at 531.5, settlement at 534.25, down 5.5 cents. The August soybean contract, a 537 high, a low at 535, and a settlement price at 535.5. They were down 6.25. Just as a reminder, we will get to the closing market report immediately following President Bush's acceptance speech in the next hour. And one other note, I believe for those of you who are on the Ag newsletter list, over the weekend we did make a mistake in that. It says that there is a meeting tonight in Sycamore. If you read that carefully, you probably realize that's not the case. It says the 3rd, and it means the 30th. That meeting, Ag Outlook panel that Dave Dickey will be hosting, is the 30th in Sycamore. That for those of you who are signed up for our Ag newsletter. Soybean meal now, 152.80 the high for the day, the low at 150.30, settlement price at 150.60 in the December contract. They were off 5 for the day. And the January at 153.80 the high, the low at 151.20. And settlement price at 151.50, and they were down 90. That December contract, not off 5, but off 50 cents, rather. December bean oil now 21.18, the high, the low at 20.48, settlement price at 20.53. They were off 46. And the January oil, 21.28, the high, the low at 20.63, settlement price at 20.64. Down 45. Celeste Quinn's here now with the Mercantile Exchange numbers.
Okay. November feeder cattle, 108.65, the high, 107.85, the low, 107.92.5, the settlement, that down 22.5. January, 105.30, the high, 104.20, the low, 104.37.5, the settlement, that down 10 cents. March feeder cattle, 101.80, the high, $100.70, the low, the settlement, $100.92.5, that down 17.5. December live cattle, 84.50, the high, 83.10, the low, 84.12.5, the settlement, that up 37.5. February, 87.40, the high, 86.30, the low, 87.17.5, the settlement, that up 37.5. December lean hogs, 71.85, the high, 70.15, the low, 71.85, the settlement, that up $2. February, 71.20, the high, 69.22.5, the low, 71.15, the settlement, that up 142. April, 67.25, the high, 66.10, the low, finishing at 66.87.5, that down 2.5. And May lean hog, 66.90, the high, 65.65, the low, the settlement, 66.40, that down 15. February bellies, 99.70, the high, 98.05, the low, the settlement, 99.65, that up 165. The Dow Jones Industrial Average currently up 93 points at 10,129. The NASDAQ is 15 higher at 1,999. And the S&P 500 is up 11 at 1,142. You're tuned to AM 580 WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. President Bush is expected to speak this afternoon, and that is coming up momentarily. That is expected to begin any minute, and we will join National Public Radio at 2 o'clock Central.